really going to affect the fire, because that snow really sticks to the fuels, to the trees and everything, and that ice clings to everything.
Snow and freezing rain helped the crew fighting a tundra fire on the edge of Dillingham. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, November 8th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, listening to the underwater sounds of the marine environment of the Arctic Ocean.
In the springtime in the Bering Sea, it's kind of like an acoustic Serengeti.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Increasing energy efficiency is an easy way to reduce energy consumption and save money. The Alaska Housing Finance Corporation now offers financing to publicly owned facilities to make improvements to increase energy efficiency. Find out more about how their loan program works and if there are public buildings in your community that are a good fit for the Alaska Energy Efficiency Revolving Loan Program at ahfc.us. This message sponsored by AHFC.
A mix of freezing rain and several inches of snow is rarely good news. But for residents in the Dillingham area who've watched a large tundra fire continue to burn since last Friday, last night's wintry mix came not a moment too soon. On Tuesday, it was estimated that the fire would burn itself out in an area contained by the Bering Sea coast and the Snake River. But through the afternoon and early and evening on Wednesday, the response team could only sit and watch as strong shifting winds forced a dramatic increase in the fire's size and spread. Then by 10 p.m. last night, the winds eased up and snow and freezing rain began to fall. Tom Dean is the Division of Forestry's fire management officer who's been coordinating the firefighting response.
The ice and the snow will probably put out almost everything in the tundra that's opened. I would say with the projected forecast within the next 2 to 3 days, with more rain and ice predicted and snow, it will probably finish off the fire. I'm not calling the fire out, but calling the fire contained and controlled as of today.
The fire, started by a remote control plane crash last Friday, has now burned an estimated 8,000 acres in the open tundra to the southwest of Dillingham. Monitoring efforts will continue. The sentencing of the former director of the Alaska Eskimo Whaling Commission continued today in federal court in Anchorage. Maggie Amawak was director of the commission for 17 years until she was fired in 2007 from the commission, which receives federal funds. She pleaded guilty in May to 2 counts of theft and misapplication of funds. The focus of the sentencing hearing has been on how much money Amawak stole from the commission. Anchorage Daily News reporter Casey Grove has been following the action in the courtroom. Hi, Casey.
Hi.
How far apart are the prosecution and the defense in their assessments of how much Maggie Amawak stole?
They're a little ways off. The prosecution has kind of totaled everything up to about $420,000, maybe a little bit more than that. And Maggie Amawak's lawyer, Kevin Fitzgerald, has said that it's a little closer to $91,000. I think $91,800 is what he landed on.
Why has it been so difficult to agree on a figure? They're quite a distance from each other.
Well, the government has figured out how much money they think has been missing from these accounts, and has said that Maggie took a lot of that money. What Fitzgerald, her lawyer, has said is that some of that actually went towards things the commission would have wanted her to do, paying per diem to commissioners, taking care of expenses, and things that she has claimed are okay, like reimbursing herself for certain things, specifically refrigerator that she bought that she says she gave to the commission. And so there's certain things that maybe aren't very well documented, but that she says have gone to benefit the commission.
As far as the documentation, when the claims are made about reimbursing commission members for per diem and travel, are there receipts or has there been a paper trail for those types of expenses?
In some cases there are. Some of the credit card statements, for instance, she had handwritten on them what the expenses were for. In other cases, like cash that she says she gave to the commissioners or board members, there's some discrepancies there. In interviews with the FBI, a couple of the board members have said they didn't remember getting any cash from her. And so she has claimed that they did, and there really isn't any kind of a paper trail for that.
Well, in addition to the per diem and some of the other things that you discussed, what's another example of something that both sides are disputing?
Well, for instance, the fact that she says that she was an hourly employee, even as the executive director of this commission, while the government says no, she actually would have been a salaried employee, and that kind of goes to overtime that she claimed. If she's a salaried employee, she really couldn't claim overtime, though she did on timesheets. In fact, in some cases, after she got paid, she went back and claimed overtime for a certain time period, which the government says is improper.
When is the hearing expected to wrap up?
Well, because of scheduling issues and because it's taken so long so far, they're actually not going to have a chance to meet again until the 28th of November. So we've got a little ways to go. It sounds like it will wrap up that day, and there should be some closing arguments. I'm sort of talking in trial terms about closing arguments and stuff, but it's oral arguments that are going to be held. They're going to try to figure out exactly what that loss amount is, and then any jail time after that, the judge will have to decide.
Casey Grove is a reporter for the Anchorage Daily News. Much of what we know about marine life in Alaska is the result of direct visual observation. Relatively recently, though, scientists began focusing more of their efforts on what goes on beneath the waves and the ice when marine life is out of sight. APRN's Josh Edge reports.
Whether looking out onto the ocean during the summer or gazing out over the sea ice in the dead of winter, the ocean can seem like a peaceful, quiet place. But that's not necessarily true.
In the springtime in the Bering Sea, it's kind of like an acoustic Serengeti.
That's Sue Moore, a biological oceanographer with the NOAA Fisheries Office of Science and Technology, who's been working with underwater acoustic technology since the 1980s. She says during springtime in the Bering Sea, you can hear the eerie trilling of a bearded seal. And maybe a walrus tapping away as well. Belugas make their presence known, calling as they swim by. And even if you ignore the noise created by marine life, Moore says the ocean can still be a very noisy place.
Sea ice can be quite loud. Subsea earthquakes sound like thunder. They can be very loud, like the thunder and lightning. Just the opening of the ocean itself, the open sea, if there's a lot of wind, if there's a storm, can be quite loud compared to an ocean that's covered by sea ice, which can be very quiet.
Moore says her team in Alaska had a very successful field season from mid-August to the latter half of September this year. They deployed 22 sensors in the Bering, Chukchi, and Beaufort Seas. The gear will sit beneath the waves, recording the environment, until a research ship picks up the sensors next year to retrieve the data. Moore is most excited about the ability to couple the audio recorders with oceanographic moorings that typically just monitor physical oceanography, like temperature, salinity, and chlorophyll levels. By using the acoustics, researchers hope to relate how the presence of marine life corresponds to the physical data.
During International Polar Year, IPY, we were able to get one of these recorders on a Canadian mooring up in the very northern Chukchi Sea, and we were very surprised to get the bowhead and beluga signals there, and it corresponded very well with when we also had the signal that there was a lot of zooplankton in the water.
The northern Chukchi mooring was the furthest north researchers had been able to sample. It was just before freeze-up, and scientists didn't expect the whales to be around. But the acoustics proved they were. According to Moore, a lot of the things we think we know about whales actually come from whaling-era observations, and finding things like belugas and bowheads in the often iced-over Arctic debunk some of those theories.
The whaling era would tell you that those species have migrated out of subarctic and Arctic waters, but really what it tells you is that the whalers could not operate in those conditions. Not necessarily that all the whales left.
Moore says for the last 10 years or so, researchers have been in an exploratory phase. She hopes the next step will be to include sound recording devices as a standard information-gathering tool, and to begin focusing in on the more acoustically interesting areas, which could lead to many more discoveries. In Anchorage, I'm Josh Edge.
To see a map of where the team placed the acoustic sensors, plus more information on the research, go to alaskapublic.org. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Lessons learned from the damaging 2002 Denali Fault earthquake.
This was the first time that a man-made structure designed to straddle an active fault that could be moving had really been tested.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the Federal Aviation Administration setting standards for the operation of aircraft in airports, faa.gov/go/flyalaska, or toll free at 1-866-357-4704. And by Older Persons Action Group, promoting well-being for Alaska seniors and their families, including publication of the monthly Senior Voice newspaper. Membership information at 1-800-478-1059.
The new Senate majority now has 12 members. Senator Gary Stevens of Kodiak has joined the majority and will be chairman of the Senate's Education Committee. Stevens had been Senate president for the last 4 years when the bipartisan coalition held power. New Senate President Charlie Huggins of Wasilla made the announcement today in a news release. Going into Tuesday's elections, the Senate was comprised of 10 Democrats and 10 Republicans, with 6 Republicans joining Democrats to form the bipartisan majority. The GOP won at least 12 seats in the general election. 2 other races are still too close to call. Senator Bert Stedman of Sitka is the only Republican coalition member who hasn't joined the new majority. Sitka officials say Stedman losing his chairmanship on the powerful Senate Finance Committee is bad news for Southeast Alaska, but they're not quite sure what the exact impact will be. KCAW's Ed Ronco has more.
Stedman had been co-chair of Senate Finance since 2007, and officials in Sitka say having him in that role for the last 6 years has helped the community.
Have we lost some strength? Absolutely.
That's Jim Dinley, Sitka's municipal administrator. He says Stedman brought a lot of grants and financial support back to Sitka.
Bert was very good to us. He made it easy for us to get appointments with other departments and other senators and representatives. We're basically back to square one.
The new Senate Finance co-chairs are Kevin Meyer of Anchorage and Pete Kelly of Fairbanks. Senate President Gary Stevens is now going to be chairman of the Education Committee, and the new Senate president is Wasilla Republican Charlie Huggins. Sitka, like many other Alaska communities, looks to the state for help funding its big infrastructure projects. That will be especially true in 2013. The city has already asked the state for $43 million to help fund its expansion of the Blue Lake Dam, one of 2 hydro projects generating electricity. Construction costs on the dam are higher than originally predicted, and that has meant a scramble to find more money. Again, Administrator Dinley.
I think Bert will still be very effective for Sitka. He's a good choice for the election. Will we be as successful? One can only hope that we would be.
Stedman could not be reached for comment before the deadline for this story. It's not known what his committee assignment will be, or even whether he'll join the Senate's majority caucus. He's the only Republican who has yet to do so. Sitka Mayor Mim McConnell says she assumes Stedman will join his GOP colleagues.
Basically, if you're not a part of the majority, then it's really hard to get things done. So I kind of expect him to join the majority, but that's also going to put pressure on him to vote for things like the big tax cuts for the oil companies, and I know he's not in favor of that.
McConnell will be one of many local officials from around the state who descend on Juneau this winter to lobby lawmakers on behalf of their hometowns.
There's so many critical issues that we're going to have to deal with that we're going to have to fight a little harder for, and that's going to take some time.
McConnell says she'll probably spend more time working the Capitol this year than she will attending the other meetings that come with a visit to Juneau. But she also is hopeful the new Senate majority will be receptive to Sitka's needs.
One of their top 3 areas of focus is delivering affordable energy to Alaskans. And Sitka fits right in with that. I mean, that's exactly what this Blue Lake project is all about.
And that will likely be what the city argues in Juneau when members of the Alaska legislature get to work in mid-January. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Ed Ronco.
Just 2 days after the election, traditional Democratic groups are pushing Republicans in Congress to protect entitlement programs as they attempt to reduce the deficit. As APRN's Peter Granitz reports, labor leaders in Alaska want Congress to tax the wealthy instead.
While not every debt watchdog will agree on the details, most recommend a combination of spending cuts and tax increases. Alaska AFL-CIO leader Vince Beltrami framed it as one or the other, and he and his union want the government to opt for the taxes, not the cuts.
In the discussions right now, we're afraid that Congress is going to come in there and take some kind of adverse action to deal with this fiscal cliff.
In his eyes, that would be cutting money from Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. Congress needs to act by the end of the year to stave off pending across-the-board cuts. Social Security and Medicaid are exempt from them, and the only cut to Medicare is a 2% reduction to medical providers. The spending cuts coincide with the end of the lower Bush-era tax rates. Beltrami wants the ones for the wealthiest Americans to expire. He's looking for a commitment from Congressman Don Young, a commitment that he won't vote to cut entitlements, either as a massive debt control package or a stopgap measure.
That's why we thought it was important to come out and say, you know, make a public request for Congressman Young to not do anything that would harm those Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid.
Beltrami says he's more comfortable with Alaska's senators. He doesn't think Senator Mark Begich or Senator Lisa Murkowski would vote to cut Social Security, Medicare, or Medicaid. But just yesterday, Republicans indicated they're open to raising revenues, Washington speak for raising taxes, if the president is willing to meet them halfway. He's expected to discuss the issue tomorrow. In Anchorage, I'm Peter Granitz.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Condor Airlines, with connecting flights from Barrow, Bethel, Juneau, Kodiak, Nome, and Prudhoe Bay to Anchorage on Alaska Airlines, and continuing nonstop service to Frankfurt. Details at condor.com.
Alaska Housing Finance Corporation offers loans tailored for first-time home buyers, plus home choice education seminars that can help determine if a mortgage would be less than rent. There's more information at ahfc.us. This message sponsored by Alaska Housing Finance Corporation.
Separate reports of birds and a seal that had oil on them have prompted local, state, and federal officials to begin an investigation on St. Lawrence Island. Coast Guard spokesman David Mosley says the culmination of reports raised red flags. A Coast Guard plane was conducting an aerial survey today, and investigators from the Guard and state were expected on scene tomorrow. The Coast Guard hasn't had any reports of damaged or sunken ships in the area. Mosley says the first report was made on October 25th about a seal that looked like it had some oil on it. Then a hunter on Monday came across birds that had oil on them. Oil samples collected yesterday were sent to Anchorage in an attempt to narrow the source. 10 years ago this week, the Denali Fault earthquake shook interior Alaska. On November 3, 2002, the 7.9 magnitude quake caused extensive damage to infrastructure along the fault line, including bridges, roads, and even an airport. Scientists and engineers have spent the last decade studying the intricacies of the earthquake, hoping to learn how to prevent damage from future earthquakes. Peter Heusler, a geologist with USGS in Anchorage, is one of those scientists. He says the Denali earthquake was a strike-slip earthquake.
The motion is kind of side to side. So if I was standing on one side of the fault and, let's say, you were standing on the other side of the fault, after the earthquake is over, then you would move laterally. You'll end up to one side or the other. In the case of the Denali Fault earthquake, the maximum motion was about 8.8 meters or around 30 feet. And so you would have ended up almost 30 feet off to my right after the earthquake if we'd been standing in this high slip area, which was kind of near Mentasta.
That seems like a lot. Is it?
It is, yeah. I mean, there's plenty of smaller earthquakes that do a lot of damage with only 1 or 2 meters of slip, you know, say 3 feet, 6 feet, something like that. But yeah, that was a huge amount.
Why have researchers been so interested in this particular earthquake?
In part, it's just that although these strike-slip earthquakes are important, for example, maybe the best known is the 1906 earthquake in San Francisco that caused all the fires, or even the 1989 Loma Prieta earthquake in California that happened during the World Series. Those are sort of two well-known strike-slip earthquakes. Ones of magnitude 7.8 or larger are really quite rare, and in the last century there was only about a half dozen of those. And it's really only been since the Cold War that our instrumentation of earthquakes and at one level our knowledge of earthquakes has increased quite a bit. And so to be able to study an earthquake like this in kind of our modern age of technology is really an important thing.
What would you say the biggest lessons that have been learned after that quake are?
Well, it's hard to know if there's one, but there was certainly a lot of successes. I think some of the lessons that were learned are we don't know everything. As we talked about, we didn't know about this one fault before the earthquake started. I think another huge success of this earthquake was the engineering of the Trans-Alaska Pipeline across the Denali Fault System. This was the first time that a man-made structure designed to straddle an active fault that could be moving had really been tested. And the pipeline did not rupture during the earthquake, even though that at the pipeline crossing, there was about 16 feet of lateral motion right there. And that's really a remarkable thing. In 1973, there was a group of earthquake geologists that went and tried to characterize the Denali Fault at that time within that area. They tried to say, okay, within this particular zone, we need to engineer for fault slippage. They came up with an estimate of about how much the fault might move in that area. And they got it pretty much right. And this earthquake was really a testament to the success of that. And I think this gets into a larger issue, which is that sometimes I think people are a little hesitant to put money into things like earthquake safety. Oh, it's, you know, another 2% or 5% of the budget of this building. But the reality was is that, you know, in the case of the pipeline, it was still working afterwards. There was a little bit of downtime for the pipeline, but basically the oil could keep flowing. If you invest a little bit into your own buildings and infrastructure, often after earthquakes, they can still be usable. And you didn't merely just survive the earthquake in that building.
How has the earthquake improved the understanding of how infrastructure responds on frozen ground? Is there lessons to be learned beyond what you just talked about with the TAPS line there?
Yes, there is. There's been some work done on bridges by a professor here at UAA, and he found that their response in earthquakes is actually quite different during the winter months when the ground is frozen versus in the summer months when the ground can move around a bit more. And I'm not an engineer, but the lesson I take away from that is you need to be really careful about how you're building these structures and not only think of one season of the year when you're doing it.
Well, I am going to ask you the question that I'm sure all geologists hate to have to field, but is the region due for another similar type earthquake anytime soon?
Well, I think at one level we don't know, and at another level we do know. And at this time, we're not able to predict earthquakes within a month or a year or, you know, an hour or a second. I think really the good thing is, though, that we are doing a much better job of being able to predict ground motions associated with an earthquake. And what that matters for you in your everyday life is that we can build buildings that are survivable. Usually it's not earthquakes that kill people, it's buildings that kill people, that buildings collapse and fall on them. And if modern building codes are actually applied to construction, which is actually fairly uneven across Alaska, then structures can be built much better to withstand them.
Peter Heusler is a geologist with USGS based in Anchorage. The future for a dog sled race between Paxson and Glen Allen was in question after most of the race board resigned last year. A series of trail, weather, and personal difficulties forced the last remaining board member to post a cancellation notice on Facebook last month. But outcry from the mushing community gave organizers a reason to regroup. As KUAC's Emily Schwing reports, the Copper Basin is back on in 2013.
According to the Facebook page for the Copper Basin 300, five board members are required for the race to continue. There's no contact information for organizers on the race website. The only remaining board member, Sarah Valentine, was unwilling to comment. She canceled the race last month, but in an email, she says a group convened in Glen Allen on Monday, and the race is back on. Three-time champion Alan Moore says the Copper Basin is famous for drama, mostly of the weather-related sort.
We thought for a long time that should be, people should run that before they're able to run a 1,000-mile race, just because, I mean, you see every type of weather condition, being cold, being snowy, there's open water, there's steep hills, there's shelf ice, there's cold temperatures. You get to see everything in a 300-mile race. It's just like Yukon Quest or Iditarod, except just a little bit shorter.
The Copper Basin is a qualifying race for both the Quest and the Iditarod. When mushers heard it was canceled, many of them scrambled to rework plans for the upcoming race season. Alan Moore and his partner Ali Zirkel will run the Kuskokwim 300 between Bethel and Aniak. That race starts a week after the Copper Basin. Moore says he and Zirkel aren't sure yet if they'll run a team in the Copper Basin now that it's back on. 35 other teams, mostly from the interior, will run a brand new mid-distance race. The Top of the World 350 runs between Tok and Eagle Village. 2012 Yukon Quest champion Hugh Neff is one of the race organizers.
I guarantee you most of the teams coming out of this race are going to be ready for the rest of the year, because it's like Charlie Boulding said, the Iditarod Trail is easy compared to what I do the rest of the year. And the way it is around here, it's more of the real deal as far as old school mushing. You know, you're going to be on your own a bit, but you're going to have a lot of experienced mushers out there, too.
It's unclear if the earlier Copper Basin cancellation resulted in a large field for the Top of the World. It's not a long-distance qualifier, but Hugh Neff says it could be in the future. Meanwhile, Copper Basin organizers haven't announced a purse. According to their Facebook page, they're still hammering out start and finish details as well. The Copper Basin starts on January 12th. In Fairbanks, I'm Emily Schwing.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Dave Benninger in Dillingham, Ed Ronco in Sitka, and Emily Schwing from Fairbanks. APRN's Peter Granitz and Josh Edge reported from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Crowley, providing tanker escorts, fuel delivery, and energy support services to Alaskans for nearly 60 years. From Valdez to the North Slope, Crowley knows Alaska. CrowleyAlaska.com. First National Bank Alaska, helping Alaska's dreams grow since 1922. On the web at FNBAlaska.com, an equal housing lender, member FDIC. And by Era Alaska. For more than 30 years, Era Alaska has been transporting packages across the state, business documents, medical supplies, even family pets. More details at flyera.com or talk to your local Era Alaska agent. Era Alaska, bringing Alaskans together. Join Alaska bars and restaurants from every corner of the state in taking a stand against secondhand smoke. The fact of the matter is, no Alaskan, employee, or customer should suffer the heart disease and lung cancer due to secondhand smoke. The benefits are undeniably positive for Alaskans and for the bottom line. Clean indoor air. It's good for health and it's great for business. For more information on smoke-free workplaces, visit alaskatca.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.